The perfect moment to begin this project is right now. Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Do you procrastinate? I do. It can be quite a problem. Now, procrastination can take many different forms. It can have many different roots. And a couple of months ago, a listener wrote to me and said, "Hey, Brett, would you do a show about procrastination?" I said, "No, I'll do a series about procrastination, and I will start it very soon." Right now, I'm thinking I can turn this topic into three or four shows. Because the more I started thinking about my own procrastination, I asked this question, well, what is at the root of it? And the answer was quite simple: worrying. What I might describe as a kind of performance anxiety. I want to start a project, but I worry that the quality of the finished product is not going to be up to my standards. I worry about biting off more than I can chew, or watching a project expand beyond what I originally intended, and it eventually becomes this time sink. Like, for example, let's talk about this show. I say, well, gosh, you know, I should talk about Albert Ellis. He's done a lot of great work on worry and anxiety and what to do about it. But I should mention this cognitive revolution in the 1950s, where he, of course, was a significant player. And then I say, oh, well, there's some caveats about this cognitive revolution, specifically how some people working inside it. It's a very broad term, so I should tell the people about, you know, all the different things that make up the cognitive revolution. And I can even mention Noam Chomsky and how his work in linguistics fits into this cognitive revolution. But then, you know, we've got this other thing where there was this talk of using computer models to better understand the human psyche, the human emotions. That makes me a little nervous, and that certainly is a kind of Pandora's box that could open up, so I got to make sure I address all of that stuff, because if I don't, somebody will write to me and say, Brett, do you know how dangerous it is to push the ideas of rational emotive therapy? Don't you know that it was connected to these cognitive scientists who wanted to build artificial intelligence machines and use them to create predictable models of human behavior? And haven't you ever read about scientism? And, you know, they've got a good point. And some people might not know what scientism is. And because I want to preempt this imaginary hostile email that I haven't received yet, I got to go get a book that has a good definition of scientism, different from some of the definitions that we've used on the show before. I should point out that the word has multiple uses. So I find a book that I think talks about scientism in this context, which is essentially applying the methodologies of the physical sciences to human beings, which is a big problem. And I find a book that I think defines it appropriately. So I open that book and I read, "Scientism is the profoundly unscientific attempt to transfer uncritically the methodology of the physical sciences to the study of human action. Both fields of inquiry must, if true, be studied by the use of reason, the mind's identification of reality. But then it becomes crucially important in reason not to neglect the critical attribute of human action, that alone in nature, human beings possess a rational consciousness." So then I say, unquote, and I close that book and I put that book down. And then I'm like, well, why am I even doing all this? Oh, yeah, because I wanted to point out some warnings, you know, the folks should be aware of when it comes to the cognitive revolution and how Albert Ellis and his rational emotive therapy fits into it. But then I'd probably be like, well, if I'm going to do caveats, I should talk about how Ellis was influenced by the work of Albert Kozipski. And I don't know that much about Albert Kozipski, so I'm going to have to look into him. Am I even pronouncing his name right? I'm going to have to go to Wikipedia to see the pronunciation for his name. But now I'm looking at it, and I don't even know what that means. What the hell is a backward C in phonetic spelling? I'm just going to say Kozipski. And then I guess I should know what general semantics is, and I should probably read through his bio while I'm there to make sure he's not like a Holocaust denier or something, because if I'm crediting him as an influence of somebody who influenced me, I'd certainly get emails if he denied the Holocaust, rightfully so. I mean, I don't mind people's emails. I just want to be sure to do my homework here. But maybe this is all just going way too far into this, and I should just edit all this out of the show. Or maybe I won't. Maybe people should know what the process is like, and I just leave this whole thing in. But that would be annoying to the people who are listening because they're like, why is he just like going on and on about what his process is in recording a show? Just do the show. If I edit it all out, it kind of assumes that the people listening to the show are inquisitive enough to, if they hear a name and if they're interested in the subject, they will go and look into the background of, say, Ellis or rational emotive behavior therapy on their own. So I can probably just delete all of that. But that kind of assumes that the people who listen to the show are impatient and intolerant, so maybe I leave it in. I don't know. So, all that being said, you might be able to see how what is supposed to be a little talk about procrastination can quickly get away from a man. These are all challenges in getting started. I find that once I start something, concerns like these will start to dissipate. And the more work I get done, even in a very large project, the more momentum I have built towards finishing that project. Sometimes, I also talked about this in the productivity series, sometimes I like to envision the end as a little extra kick, a little extra motivator. That is very helpful as well. But starting for me is the most difficult thing, and the root of that procrastination is worry in one form or another. So I thought, why not devote a whole show to the activity of worrying? And in today's presentation, I'm going to be using the work of a therapist, a psychologist that I greatly respect, and I've embraced quite a few of his methods. His name is Albert Ellis, and he is the founder of Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy. And you might remember some of this from the inner monologue that I did out loud less than a minute ago. I want to talk a little bit about what that is, maybe address a few of the criticisms just to get a little running start here. But without getting terribly hung up, we're going to keep moving forward to answer this question, is worrying rational? Or better yet, can it be transformed into something rational? And of course, what can the work of Albert Ellis and Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy teach us about different types of worry and anxiety and about some strategies, if we practice them with patience and persistence, that might help us overcome some of these challenges. So that was a terrific intro. So let's start with Ellis, just so you know who he is. First of all, Ellis is considered to be one of the prime movers in the cognitive revolution of the 1950s. So this was a very important shift in several fields, including psychology, anthropology, and linguistics. The genesis of neuroscience is in this cognitive revolution. What's important for me, at least in the discipline of psychology, it was an answer to the prevailing experimental psychological practice of that time, which was, of course, behaviorism, the work of B.F. Skinner. And when it came to psychotherapy, that field was dominated at that time by the theories of Sigmund Freud. So this is a very important evolution in therapy and psychology. And in the late 1940s, Ellis starts to break away from what was at the time the psychological mainstream, dominated by Freud's theories and behaviorism. And he's got a couple of influences, just Albert Kazibsky, General Semantics, if you want to do your own exploration. I want to keep moving forward here, if you don't mind. He starts to develop his own psychotherapeutic practice, which he calls Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy. It is, to the best of my knowledge, the original form of cognitive behavioral therapy, which, according to Cognitive Behavior Therapy Basics and Beyond, is a structured, short-term, present-oriented psychotherapy for depression, directed towards solving current problems and modifying dysfunctional, inaccurate, or unhelpful thinking and behavior. So this combination of cognitive therapy and behavior therapy is today used to treat everything from anxiety disorders, personality disorders, eating disorders, substance abuse, and even more severe psychotic disorders. Back to REBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, the Albert Ellis Institute defines it as an action-oriented psychotherapy that teaches individuals to identify, challenge, and replace their self-defeating thoughts and beliefs with healthier thoughts that promote emotional well-being and goal achievement. Albert Ellis, by the way, another Columbia graduate. It's where he got his PhD from Teachers College. So he joins the ranks of other School Sucks favorites, Thaddeus Russell and John Taylor Gatto. And Tom Woods, by the way. Did you know that? So that's just a minimal background on Ellis and REBT. But why this? Why now? Well, first of all, a couple of reasons. Personal reason first. For the last 3 months, I have gotten pretty into the practice of meditation. You might remember I talked about it, but then procrastinated until about November. Now, when I first started, the exercise was simple. It was exactly what Kyle Davis suggested, which was sit quietly with your back straight, start with a manageable amount of time each day or every other day, and just try to focus on your breath. Once I was able to feel comfortable with this practice, what I started to do was mindfulness meditation, which was suggested by Daniel Siegel in his Taking Time In presentation that we've discussed on the show before. Now, this is a new challenge. What you're trying to do in mindfulness meditation is to not super focus on your thoughts or what's going on in your body, but just to become aware of it, to let things come in to the quiet mind, acknowledge them, and then move on. And I do try to return to this focus on breathing, but I do acknowledge what's happening without obsessing about it during the meditation process. So after I do meditation, I try to do it 5 days a week on weekdays. I reflect on what the thoughts were that came through, and almost all of them could be categorized as worries. So I realized that this is what's kind of playing in the background of my mind. You know, even in a quiet mind, the thoughts that creep in wasn't goals, wasn't aspirations, it wasn't fond memories. It seemed like a lot of the subtleties of my thinking were really worries and anxieties. So this was definitely something that I wanted to address for personal reasons. The other thing is that we just finished this show on Stoicism. I was introduced to Albert Ellis and rational emotive behavior therapy maybe 3 or 4 years ago. But I realized after all of the discussions that I had with Bill Buport that a lot of the theory of REBT lines up with the philosophy of Stoicism. And simply put, it's this. When we have bad things happen in life, that's not what's upsetting us. The upset, the frustration, the worry, the anger, whatever it is, it comes from how our views of reality are constructed, our philosophies, our beliefs, the language that we use. So REBT is a practical therapy where participants make use of a lot of tools, and we're going to talk about one of those tools on the show today. And I'm going to be pulling from a couple of Ellis's books. One is called How to Control Your Anxiety Before It Controls You, which was written in the year 2000. And another book called Overcoming Procrastination, or How to Think and Act Rationally in Spite of Life's Inevitable Hassles, written in 1977. A lot of this information is also available in a fairly entertaining presentation Ellis gave in the early 90s called 21 Ways to Stop Worrying. There are a few criticisms of Ellis that are probably worth addressing very quickly. One, I just got to get out of the way. The other one, I think, will help us move forward with some valuable information. Early in his career, Ellis worked as a sexologist and love researcher. He did a lot of work with Alfred Kinsey. He had some views on homosexuality that today we would consider unenlightened. He had this idea that it could be cured. In the 1970s, there were some significant shifts in the psychiatric community on the issue of homosexuality. And Ellis eventually developed what I believe to be a more enlightened position on the subject, that, of course, homosexuality didn't need to be labeled as a pathology or something that needed to be cured. The other criticism, some critics have tried to suggest that rational emotive behavior therapy is too narrow in focus, that it relies on a fairly rigid formula and fails to address deep underlying problems. Well, to this I would say that most of the problems that we experience in life have three components to them: a physiological, biological component, a behavioral component, and a psychodynamic component. And all three kind of work together. So let's use anxiety disorders as an example. Some have tried to approach anxiety disorders as purely a biological problem. Others have tried to approach anxiety disorders as behavioral problems, and others still have tried to approach them as psychodynamic problems. So let's just go through each one. The biological theory essentially suggests that there's a chemical imbalance in the brain, or of course, genetic factors. Now, if certain psychological problems are viewed as only biological in origin, we see how people could, you know, wind up on prescription drugs for some kind of issue that might have other remedies. The behavioral theory would say that whatever the psychological issue is the result of some learned behavior, including learned negative thought patterns. And this is where REBT really does focus. And of course, the psychodynamic theory would look at, say, childhood issues, especially with something like anxiety or substance abuse. We would likely find some significant childhood trauma. But all three of these things seem to work together. So there's a Free Domain Radio series that was done a few years ago called The Bomb in the Brain, right? And that's obviously addressing all three, that we have psychodynamic considerations, childhood trauma, actually having a physiological impact, and then that physiological or biological outcome leads to adverse or destructive behaviors. And it doesn't have to happen in that order. Obviously, the problem could be biological first, right? And I would, with biological, I would even include things like diet. If I feel anxious, I would say, well, what's my caffeine intake? Am I getting enough omega-3s? Have I been eating too many processed foods? And let's remember, too, that, you know, childhood trauma is kind of a vague term. Certain childhood issues that don't involve severe abuse could have a significant effect on people later in life. I mean, remember that when most of us are young, one of the most important lessons that we learn is to behave. And even though being quote unquote good when we're little tykes is a top priority, we're told, we really don't know too much about what that means. And unfortunately, we have to rely on other people's definitions of good and bad, and that shapes us. So we become very susceptible to what bigger people think we should be, you know? So we become people pleasers later in life. And the result of this for many is, you know, low self-esteem, fear of abandonment, fear of rejection, trouble saying no. So even though many people out there in the world would not consider the generally accepted treatment and management of children to be severe childhood trauma, those experiences obviously can have important psychodynamic implications later in life. So the point is that even though rational emotive behavior therapy does focus on behavior, all of these factors are intertwined. Changing behavior can change physiology. Changing behavior can change psychodynamics. Changing behavior can allow you to address physiological issues and psychodynamic issues. So even though the problem involves the interplay of all three, so does the solution. I hope that's clear. And I think that from what I've seen, rational emotive behavior therapy does address all three, even though, of course, the primary focus is on cognitive restructuring, which, definition very quickly, a therapeutic process of learning to identify and dispute irrational or maladaptive thoughts known as cognitive distortions. And some examples of cognitive distortions, we've talked about them on the show before: all or nothing thinking, filtering, overgeneralization, magnification, emotional reasoning, making up causal relationships where there aren't any. So there's plenty more detail, of course, that we could go into here when it comes to rational emotive behavior therapy. But I'm hoping to elucidate more of the theory and practice through this discussion specifically about worrying and anxiety. So Ellis explained worry, or the general term anxiety, manifesting in life in three forms. I'll start with one form that many of us are probably at least vaguely familiar with, and it's worrying about conditions, worrying about the world, experiencing a low frustration tolerance. And if we're not careful about low frustration tolerance, because we look out at the world, we read through our Facebook, we turn on CNN, God forbid, and we say, man, am I surrounded by the stupids here. This can result in self-pity, a feeling of smallness, a lack of efficacy, and our frustration tolerance is really something that, for me anyway, that I really need to be conscious of, because it sneaks up on you. It sneaks up on you in traffic. It sneaks up on you at the line. And by yeah, I mean me. It sneaks up on me in line at the grocery store, and it can really start to pollute my thinking if I'm not careful about it. So this is a general kind of low-grade, who is going to get in my way today kind of worry or anxiety. Another type that Ellis discussed was discomfort worry. And for many of us, this is also very pervasive. And just like worrying about conditions and worrying about the world, it can often take the form of hostility towards others. This is more about the familiar world than the unfamiliar world that I just described. What are the police doing today in Missouri? Or who's going to be in front of me in line today at the convenience store buying scratch tickets for a goddamn half an hour using the entire place like their own personal casino? Give me two bingos, he says. Oh, why don't you buy three, you mumble to yourself, instead of sighing audibly for the third time while you wait to pay for gas because you have somewhere you need to be. Or again, me. I do that. But unlike that first type of worry, the conditions worry, the world worry, the Ferguson situation, the scratch ticket man, the second type of worry deals more with the people we actually know and what our expectations of those people are. And it's a lot of like shoulds and musts. You must treat me kindly. You must not force me to do anything. So relationship worry is this second type, I would say. It's a big part of it. Relationships is a big part of it. Even though both of these first two forms of worry involve what I would say is an over-concern about something called fairness. So finally, the third type of worry, and the one that is most relevant to our discussion here today, and I'm going to go to a clip of Albert Ellis in 1991 explaining it.
Ego worry or ego anxiety. People worry about their doing poorly and putting themselves down for it. And the poor, as I'll say in a little while, usually means not succeeding at what they want to succeed at, and also not succeeding in their relationships. They worry much more about their relationships often than anything else. But ego worry or ego anxiety has many forms, such as anxiety itself and shame and shyness, which usually means scared shitless, and embarrassment and humiliation and insecurity feelings, it's often called, and I often call it self-downing, putting oneself down, inadequacy feelings, lack of confidence, withdrawal from things that you may fail at or may be rejected at. Feelings of hurt very frequently have self-downing in them. And unassertiveness, again, the reason why people are unassertive usually is because they're afraid to fail and will put themselves down for failing. Procrastination very often stems from worry. If I do this thing poorly or not perfectly, then I'm no damn good. And sometimes hostility is a cover-up for worry. And when you're hostile, you're really worried underneath. You're first worried, anxious, and then to cover it up, sometimes you get hostile. And this form, ego anxiety, which is usually the most dramatic form of worry because you put you down, and nobody presumably is more important to you than you, but actually the irony is the opposite, because when you're worried, you're making other people and other things more important than you and saying, I personally as a human am no damn good when those other things go wrong or I make them wrong. And the core of most anxiety, one form of it, the main core of this form is, of ego anxiety, is self-downing. I must absolutely do well and be loved, adored, approved by other humans, especially significant others, meaning those that I think of as significant. And it's awful or horrible or scary to fail, to be rejected, to look foolish, to make a fool of myself, to even appear anxious, not only to be anxious, but it adds another vector that if I appear anxious to other humans, that's terrible, to speak poorly, etc., etc. There are a million of them. But normally they're involved with two main things, and one is performance. Performance anxiety is the issue. But the other thing is really a form, in a sense, of performance, and that is approval. But I really tell myself, or you tell yourself, because of course I'm not worried about any damn thing anymore, I'm rational, so we'll talk about you rather than me. You tell yourself that I not only have to perform well at school, at work, at sports, at you name it, but especially, again, at love. I have to win the approval, gain the approval, perform correctly to win the approval of other humans. So the big and most dramatic form of worry, and probably the most common form, is ego worry. Ego anxiety, performance anxiety, the dire need for approval, not just the wish or the want or the preference for performance and approval. Everybody has that. Every human who's in the least human would have that. But the dire necessity to perform well and to perform well in human, especially love relationships.
So focusing on this third type of worry, even though these other two forms of worry do affect and do play into ego worry, rational emotive behavior therapy suggests some tools and a specific practice referred to as ABC. I'm going to go through what each letter stands for, and then we'll talk about it in some detail. A, an activating event, or I guess adversity or agitation. B, the belief about that activating event, adversity or agitation. And C, the consequences of that belief. Now, worry generally, for me anyway, produces a sense of overwhelm that hampers productivity. So even if, like at the beginning when I talked about performance anxiety, I talked about these concerns I had about a specific project. But if I'm experiencing more of this generalized anxiety or worry, I'm not going to be in the productive, focused mindset I need to be in to even start that project. So the worry can apply specifically, like lasered in on what I'm actually trying to do, or, and this is especially true before I found GTD, it can be all of these things swirling around outside of that. So it's relevant in both cases. And running the triggers for worry through this ABC tool can be very beneficial, I have found. So I would say it like this. We all have goals, motivating factors, values. And Ellis sums them up pretty simply. He said, we all want to succeed. We all want to be approved of. We all want to be comfortable. Of course, you could go to an NVC site or just Google something like needs inventory if you wanted a more complete list. The activating events that we're talking about here, or the adversity, situations where our values, goals, or needs are not honored, or at least we feel that way. So when these adverse situations come up, we start to form B, beliefs about A, activating events. Some of our beliefs can be very rational, and that's great. We might have wishes, we might have wants, we might have desires or assessments. of the activating events. But for many of us, there's also an irrational follow-up, which usually takes the form of command or demand or shoulds or oughts or musts. And those irrational beliefs about the original event have C, consequences. Now, the consequences of the rational beliefs can be, you know, feeling appropriately sorry, regretful, annoyed. And that's good because it can send us back to taking another look at the activating event to reevaluate. We can often have inappropriate feelings as consequences, horror, terror, panic, etc. But at this point, if we can slow things down appropriately, we're actually presented with a choice. We can have, you know, positive consequences which result in action. We acknowledge the wishes or wants or desires that we had about A, and we can either act and change it or act in acceptance of whatever the original event was. And one of the reasons why I think this tool is potentially so valuable, especially as a follow-up to our big series on Stoicism, is if practiced carefully and thoughtfully, it shows us what is within our sphere of control and what isn't. And of course, that's very helpful in developing some kind of a contingency plan. But then there's bad consequences, which is what we're talking about here today. Anxiety, shame, creating unnecessary stress with those words like should and must and ought. So why are these such shitty words? If we always got our way, these would be awesome words. This would be the end of any problem. You know, like, oh, I see I have a little activating event here. Well, it should blank, you must blank, and everybody ought to blank. So problem solved, and I am out of here. That's rarely the case. There are many contributing factors to the problem of worry and anxiety, and they are usually things that are out of our sphere of control. They may be direct causes. They may be the actual activating events that we're trying to work through with this tool. For example, major life changes brought on by, say, illness or a death of a loved one, out of your control. But there are many contributors to anxiety that through prevention plans and proactivity, practice and planning are within our sphere of control. In fact, for me, one of the greatest contributors to stress and anxiety was the awareness of things in my life that I could control, that I could manage, but I wasn't even attempting to rein them in. One that I already touched on was the lack of focus, right? If you're already disorganized or out of sorts, when something new and unfortunate or even urgent is thrown at you and your mind is not like water, well, you know, these things can be pretty disturbing. So if you're not goal-oriented, if you're lacking focus, if you're lacking commitment, that is a contributing factor that makes the adverse event seem more severe. Ellis had a couple on the list that I thought were interesting. What he called the lack of hardiness, being vulnerable, being weak, obviously something that could be fluid throughout our lives. Sometimes we might feel very hardy, and other times we might feel more vulnerable. The lack of leisure or too much leisure. But the ego worry is also important because it affects how we look at the amount of stressors. It also affects our sense of what the outcomes need to be. And that's important because I just talked about two kinds of contributors to stress and anxiety and worry. The first kind, things that are completely outside of our sphere of control. The second kind, which, like I said, for me personally, could be even more stressful, things that I could be managing, things that I could be addressing, but I'm not. But either way, with either type of stressor, in the sphere of control or outside of the sphere of control, as far as the actual activation of that event is concerned, we still have a choice. Ellis talks about this. Bill Buport talked about this. All the great Stoics of the past talked about this. What are you going to do with this event? It's not the event itself that is traumatic or stressful. It is your thinking about it. That is what Epictetus was talking about when he said, quote, in life, our first job is this, to divide and distinguish things into two categories, externals that I cannot control, but the choices that I make with regard to them I do control. Where will I find good and bad? In me. in my choices, unquote. That is what rational emotive behavior therapy is all about. So that's why this ABC tool is so important. It sounds so obvious, right? It sounds like a thing you would tell a six-year-old, like in first grade. Hey, kids, welcome to school. Over the next 70 or 80 years, you're probably going to run into some adversity. So here's a little tool you could use to, at times when necessary, slow down your thoughts and maybe prevent some unnecessary hardships in life. It comes down to the simple question that we hear in every parody of therapy ever. How does that make you feel? But dare I say, there are too few of us here on Earth asking that question in a serious way of ourselves. How does this thing make me feel? We just feel. And then we act. Or we feel more about our feelings. So this ABC and really like slowing things down in the middle, I think, leads to better emotional consequences and subsequent actions. And for me, up to this point in life, the key to overcoming almost every worry that I've overcome so far has been some form of action. Now, of course, there are those situations that provide exceptions. I see blue lights in my rearview mirror. I say, "Oh, I'm going to get pulled over, and there's going to be a federal warrant for my arrest, and I'm going to be taken to some kind of detention center because I didn't respond to a letter from the IRS because it went to my mom's house instead of where I live, and I think I just peed a little." But then it turns out that the cop flies right by me with his lights on because he's going somewhere else. And then I also remembered that I wear Depends adult diapers while I'm driving, like that astronaut woman who was in the news a few years back, because stopping to go when you have a busy lifestyle can be a real pain. Now, whether I made that all up or not, the worry is relieved completely, no action required by me. But for most worries, the remedy is some form of action, or the action of acceptance. So when something happens in life, some adverse event or agitation, when I get to that B stage, I make a very, very conscious effort to separate rational beliefs, wishes, wants, desires about the original event that lead to positive action from irrational beliefs or commands, demands, shoulds, oughts, musts that lead to worry and disempowerment. Or lack of action. And I'm still practicing this. If I can do what Epictetus advised in that quote, I could turn any event into two lists. One, a list of appropriate concerns and subsequent actions, and the other that has no plan of action. So appropriate concern is helpful. It can be exciting. It can lead to adventure. It can lead to challenging our thoughts, pushing us to achieve greater enjoyment of life, greater mental and physical health. The other list only seems to produce horror, terror, and panic. So having those two lists, it's kind of like a cost-benefit analysis. You see where your focus needs to go. So gosh, I said I was going to keep these short. In the next show, we're going to talk more about how to follow up the ABC. I highly recommend, if you're trying to minimize stress, worry, anxiety in your life, I don't mean to do like a buy my book thing here at the end. Please check out our series on presence and productivity. If you can't stand the sound of my voice, buy the book, Getting Things Done by David Allen. I'm sure you could find a PDF of it or an audiobook somewhere on the internet for free. You know how to do those things. And also check out the shows I did with Gino Denning on the Trivium, or go to tragedyandhope.com to their resources page. They've got a bunch of great material on the Trivium as well. And check out the shows I did with Daryl Becker on connected communication. It's called The Trivium Applied to Communication. Because when it comes to the question of anxiety, what can we do about it? I mean, first of all, GTD, simplify life, get more structure, plan ahead, manage your time better, don't be working all the time. Break up the things that will contribute to your stress level into smaller, more manageable pieces. Don't overwork yourself. and accept the fact that you're going to have some mediocre outcomes in life. The trivium, which is about identification, problem solving, and making those two processes useful. Having the freedom and the confidence to try different solutions, to seek better solutions, to be able to check your solutions. You can use the trivium, as I have, to try and better protect yourself against stress and anxiety. What are the biological roots of stress? What are physical remedies for worry and anxiety? How can you reinforce these things? And that communication stuff is really important as well, because in that series, we stress the idea that before you can be communicating peacefully and beneficially with others, you have to be doing it with yourself. And I hope what we talked about today was a useful tool to that end. So, to be continued very soon. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care.